This is a number I'm going to remember forever. And it's only going to get bigger by the end of this administration. If you had to guess, right now, I think we have some, is it around $32 trillion in debt? Or is it $37 trillion? $39 trillion. Do you know what percentage of the debt is due to Trump's admin?
Oh, percentage? I don't.
It's
I would guess.
27%. A quarter
Jesus.
Of the U.S. debt. And I don't even know where that number comes from. I don't know if that includes, like, because it's impossible to make this argument because conservatives' minds explode. Most of the borrowing that we had to do under Biden can be fairly blamed on Trump because we lost so much revenue from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that the loss of all that revenue necessitated more deficit spending because it wasn't paired with any spending cuts, right? So the majority of the borrowing that Biden even had to do in his admin was to fund these stupid Trump tax cuts that Trump never paired with any spending cuts. I don't know if that 27% even includes that or if it's literally just including the... Can somebody link me where this... Is it literally just the money borrowed? I guess I should be able to look this up, right? U.S. deficit by year, going back 10 years.
So Bush had a 72% change in the debt. Obama, 64%. Trump in his first term, 40%.
Okay, so So Trump would have been responsible for the spending through all of 2017 through 2021, right? Or no?
Yep.
2017, 2016 to 2019, 18, 19, right? 20. Okay. He borrowed... It would have been 680... This would be billion, and then 872 billion, 1 trillion, 3.4 trillion. So
3.4 trillion was 3. For COVID, 3, yeah?
Yeah, 4.3, 5.1, 2.9. So this would be about 5.9, almost 6 trillion?
I got the number here. 7.8 trillion. Here, look at this website.
Yeah, what do you show me?
It's a really good way to say it. Scroll a little further.
Yeah, same way the article was written. Okay. Measure by comparing the national debt level when a president enters office to the level when a president leaves to calculate the percentage increase or decrease in debt during the presidency. The first year in office, though, aren't you technically, like, it's you're borrowing for, the, is it the last year's spending? Am I kind of correct in saying that, or?
I would assume so, because it's usually made by the last president, right?
I don't know how the fiscal years work out. Top five presidents who added to the national debt by percentage is FDR, Woodrow Wilson, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and then Barack Obama. National debt continues to rise under President Trump.
You missed the Kino graph. I just sent it to you.
Wait, oh, above?
Yeah, there it is.
Percentage change of the debt. Oh, sure. What does that mean? 7.8 trillion, and the percentage change is 40%. So that means that it was, so X times 0.4 is 7.8, and X would have been the, so our debt was
previous
like,
debt.
What, like 17 trillion when Trump came into office his first term?
18, I think, but yeah.
Okay.
Maybe 19, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Obama ended his term with basically $20 trillion in debt, yeah.
Okay, $20 trillion in debt. And then
Trump in his first term did $8 trillion, and now, I mean, didn't you say he added like $3 trillion already?
No way, in 1 year? And then Biden spent 8.5. I'm curious about that 27% number, how people calculated that. Fuck, I clicked an article yesterday and then I didn't. I should have read through the whole thing.
Oh, you're saying like 27% of like the total debt we've ever had? Or are you saying 27% of the current debt?
That's the same thing, kind of. It's our debt.
Kind of, but debt got paid off at one point.
Sure, of our current debt, I guess.
Okay, okay. Who's the last person to balance the budget?
Bill Clinton.
Bill?
Yeah.
Blowjob Bill. Bubba.
The U.S. national debt soared past $39 trillion this week amid growing concerns. The figure published by the Bureau of Fiscal Service consists of over $31.3 trillion in public debt on top of the $7.6 trillion in intragovernmental holdings. There is also an article that I needed to read. Fuck. Somebody linked an article, it was posted to Our Economics, about how our real debt is actually like over like $100 trillion. And it sounds like a fucking like a retarded meme thing with like some shit you'd see on ProPublica. But the argument made by the author was actually really compelling. It had to do with like how the CBO scores stuff out and that there are outstanding obligations the U.S. has that like you could legitimately believe that. Oh, is it this? It was this. It might be at this point. Who knows? We'll only know when it's too late. The U.S. national debt is nearly $39 trillion. One of the country's top fiscal economists says the real number is closer to $100 trillion and that Washington's own accounting rules are designed to hide it. As this went to press, the national debt clock stood at $38.92 trillion per Treasury data. According to Kent Smetters, faculty director of the Penn-Wharton budget model and one of the country's most respected fiscal economists, that $39 trillion number is a polite fiction. The real tab, he argues, is closer to $100 trillion. It has to do with the accounting distinction between explicit obligations, legally binding debts the government must repay, and implicit pay-as-you-go obligations, expected future spending commitments that carry moral or political but not legal force. What we call implicit obligations are twice the size of explicit obligations, Smetters told Fortune in a recent interview, referring to the unfunded liabilities buried inside programs like Social Security and Medicare. The U.S. government were required to report its finances under the same accounting rules as a publicly traded corporation. Smetters pointed out the debt-to-GDP ratio wouldn't be the current level of 100%, which is bad enough. We'd be reporting a debt-to-GDP ratio closer to 300%. The gap between those two numbers, he warned, is not a rounding error. It is the deliberate product of federal accounting standards designed to keep the full picture hidden from the public. A shell game, not a Ponzi scheme. Smetters is careful about the language he uses. Critics with Social Security have long compared the pay-as-you-go structure to a Ponzi scheme, in which early investors are paid with money from later ones. Smetters rejects that framing. It's not a Ponzi scheme, Smetters says. It's a shell game, insisting that the distinction matters. A Ponzi scheme implies fraud, but Social Security never promised a higher return than market returns. It's more of a shell game because Social Security and entitlement reforms can be moved obligations off book. Can be moved obligations off book from explicit treasury obligations to implicit pay-as-you-go liabilities because federal budget rules do not account for implicit liabilities. In 2001, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill attempted to explicitly book the value of pay-as-you-go liabilities, but several events later that year, including the 9/11 attacks and the Enron meltdown, shifted the focus toward more immediate challenges. The newer accounting framework was outlined in a 2003 book published by the American Enterprise Institute. In Washington's case, Smetters said, that misdirection is written directly into federal law. His Beltway credentials include a stint as an economist at the Congressional Budget Office and as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Treasury. And PWBM is widely used in Washington, D.C. to analyze the fiscal and macroeconomic effects of federal policy proposals. So he knows what he's talking about when he rattles off from memory. Accounting legislation from 1985 is the origin of this shell game. By statute, Smetters pointed out, the CBO is required to analyze Social Security on what's known as a scheduled benefits basis, meaning its models assume the program will pay out full promised benefits indefinitely, even after the trust fund is completely exhausted. The problem, of course, is that current law also requires benefits to be automatically slashed the moment the fund runs dry, while the CBO is legally barred from modeling that reality. This accounting quirk has enormous political consequences. It allows lawmakers to craft Social Security reform bills that appear on paper to close the program's long-term funding gap, while actually doing nothing of the sort. Smetters points to the Social Security 2100 Act as a prime example. The bill was widely celebrated for eliminating the program's 75-year actuarial shortfall. In reality, he argued, it actually worsened the long-term picture by increasing implicit debt by more than $1 for every $1 of reduction in explicit debt. Smetters said he believes this was an unintentional effect. It can just happen when working with an incomplete accounting framework that focuses on explicit federal debt. This bill simply shifted costs from the explicit ledger, where they show up in official debt projections, to the implicit ledger, where they vanish from public view entirely. They reduced these explicit liabilities, but it actually increased implicit liabilities by even more. And so instead of helping future generations, instead of incentivizing saving and labor, it ultimately, in the end, did the opposite. Handcuffed accounting. As a longtime budget watcher, Smetters attributed the issue to something almost mystical in the gears of government, remnants of legislation that remain even as Congress keeps writing new bills to supposedly correct the errors from previous regimes. In particular, he pointed to powerful remnants rooted in the 1985 Graham-Rudman-Hollings Balanced Budget Act, which effectively prevent the agency from projecting discretionary spending to grow faster than inflation over the budget window. During his own three-year tenure at CBO, Smetters claimed staff recognized this constraint as unrealistic and effectively required CBO to consistently produce debt projections that were too optimistic. One of the things that's left over from Graham-Rudman-Hollings, Smetters explained, is that CBO, by law, is not allowed to grow discretionary spending faster than inflation over the next decade, over the budget window. And if you ask them, does this modeling make sense? They'll be the first to say, no, this absolutely makes no sense. In practice, this means the CBO long-range models have a structural problem built into them. They constantly underestimate the growth in the debt, Smetters said. Congress passed the 1985 law in a moment of genuine fiscal panic. Deficits had exploded during the early Reagan years, and lawmakers, desperate for a mechanism to enforce discipline, created a statutory framework that required automatic spending cuts, sequestration, whenever the deficit exceeded present or preset targets. To make that system work, the law needed a standardized apples-to-apples definition of what counted as a deficit, so Section 257 codified the rules governing CBO's official budget baseline. The political logic was straightforward. By locking in assumptions about what programs were supposed to spend, Congress could measure any new legislation against a fixed ruler. The agency also faces restrictions on dynamic scoring, the practice of modeling how a policy change ripples through the broader economy, for any measure that affects fewer than 1 million people. This is a pretty 91-2, Smetters said. The blinds budget and analysts to hundreds of billions of dollars in potential tax revenue generated by high-skilled immigrants over their lifetimes, he explained. Oh, this blinds budget analysts to hundreds of billions of dollars in potential tax revenue generated by high-skilled immigrants over their lifetimes, he explained. Even high-skilled STEM workers who pay much more in taxes than they receive in benefits are scored as losing the government money on average, he explained, pointing to a 2024 analysis of this published by PWBM from former CBO director Douglas Elmendorf and MacArthur Genius Grant awardee Heidi Williams. Setting aside the politics, Smetters argued, the economics suffer. Suppose that we were to shift immigration away from low-skilled to high-skilled workers, even though we know those high-skilled STEM workers, for example, they're going to pay a lot more taxes. CBO is not allowed to account for that. The result is a federal budgeting apparatus that, through an accumulation of outdated rules and political compromises, consistently produces rosier projections than reality warrants. 6 years to a Social Security reckoning. For Social Security specifically, the law directed CBO to assume that scheduled benefits would be paid in full indefinitely, It was a conservative modeling choice at the time because the trust fund was healthy following the 1983 reforms. What nobody fully reckoned with was that this assumption would become permanently embedded in law, transforming what was meant as a neutral accounting convention into a tool that could make structurally insolvent legislation appear fiscally responsible on paper. At one time, according to Smetters, there simply wasn't a budget problem in the United States because there wasn't an automatic stabilizer, like in the Graham-Redmond-Hollings legislation, to keep benefits from growing at the same rate. If you just look at the data, he added, discretionary spending clearly grows with the size of the economy. I mean, it grows clearly faster than inflation, but it can't do that by law. Graham-Redmond-Hollings was never explicitly, or Hollings, was never explicitly overturned, just parts of it bit by bit. And so CBO just is not allowed to grow discretionary spending faster than inflation. The stakes of these accounting games are about to become very real. The Social Security Trust Fund, which covers old age and survivor's insurance, is now projected to be depleted by 2032, 1 year earlier than the CBO estimated just months ago, a provision driven in part by recent tax legislation. When that happens, the program is legally required to cut benefits to whatever level incoming payroll taxes can support, a figure currently estimated at roughly 84% of the scheduled payments. Tens of millions of retirees would face automatic cuts with no congressional action required to trigger them. That looming deadline should be forcing urgent reform debates in Washington. Instead, Smetters said, turning inwardly critical, although he said he doesn't believe PWBM is a bad offender in this regard, years of alarmist rhetoric about crisis from think tanks and budget hawks have left lawmakers cynical and disengaged. They're kind of tired of the boy who cries wolf, he says. They've been saying the sky is falling for the longest time, but the sky hasn't exactly fallen yet, he said, likening it to predictions that the world was supposed to be underwater by now. That's a dangerous approach, he said, adding that what really needs to be done is really serious, thoughtful discussion of modeling and explaining to people. That fatigue is dangerous because time is the one resource that fiscal reformers are rapidly running out of. The longer Congress waits, Smetters warned, the narrower the range of available solutions becomes. A structural fix implemented today could be spread gradually across generations. Modest adjustments to the retirement age, phase benefit recalibrations, incremental revenue increases. A fix implemented in 2031 under pressure of imminent insolvency will look very different. A steep tax hike rather than a gradual structural adjustment. Underlying all of its matters argued is an epistemic failure in how Washington evaluates fiscal policy. The simplified models and politically convenient scoring rules that dominate budget debates don't just misrepresent the debt, they actively mislead the policymakers who are supposed to fix it. The Treasury's own financial report of the United States government puts the 75-year unfunded shortfall at $73.2 trillion, driven entirely by Social Security and Medicare. The reason the distinction matters is compounding urgency. The longer these implicit liabilities remain off the official ledger, the less pressure lawmakers fail to address them, while the actual cost of closing the gap grows larger each year. The CBO already projects that deficits will hit $1.9 trillion in fiscal year 2026. That's crazy. And ballooned to $3.1 trillion by 2036 under current law. And that projection still assumes Social Security pays full benefits even after the trust fund is projected to run dry around 2032, obscuring just how much worse the trajectory actually is. Without transparent, micro-funded economic models that capture the true generational transfer of costs, he warns, lawmakers will keep falling for proposals that shuffle liabilities from one column to another without changing anything fundamental. They're just going to get duped into simplistic solutions that really don't do much, he said. The United States is not, Smetters insisted, on the verge of imminent collapse. The debt is manageable, in theory, but the window for a manageable solution is closing, and the accounting rules that were supposed to help Washington navigate a path forward are, by design, pointing in the wrong direction. Damn. I think that what's being talked about here is the idea that let's assume this is the amount of money you have to spend to fund your government. Like, this is how it's accounted for ordinarily. And then let's assume that this is how much money you need to fund Social Security. I think what the article is saying is that if you look at how Social Security gets paid into and you look at how Social Security pays out, that in 2032, right here, there's going to be a shortfall in how much money is available for Social Security. But that this shortfall for where the additional funding would have to come from is not accounted for in ordinary budget projections. And as soon as we run into this, we're obviously going to have to do something about it because it's going to be hugely unpopular to just slash Social Security benefits by 15%. And so we're going to have to start borrowing a ton more money to pay for this thing that no budget projection is currently accounting for because they just don't account for things like that and the way that we do budget projections for Congress, for the way the CBO models stuff, which would obviously be bad.
Isn't it kind of retarded that somebody who has like $20 million in the bank still gets Social Security?
Maybe.
I don't know how much it would matter, I guess, in the long run. Like, I don't know how much are we actually losing by all of these people with money getting Social Security? I don't know if it's like a number that should even be worried about or what, but.
People really don't like means testing, or at least
it's retarded.
The economy people on the left don't like me. I don't know. Probably, I feel like a couple things you could do to help Social Security is you could, I don't know.
Take off the max amount that people have to pay in taxes for it?
Well, you would slowly raise the cap. You wouldn't just take off the maximum because that'd be a huge, massive tax increase out of nowhere. But you could definitely.
The United States needs in tax increases.
Yeah, I think you could. I think you could lift that Social Security tax. Somebody says it stops at $400K a year. Is that true? I thought it was like 170.
I thought it was like 200K.
How much income Social Security tax applied to? is 176K right now. Like, I think you could lift that to 200 or 250. Should you phase out benefits? The thing is, Social Security is like a thing you pay into, and people feel like they're entitled to it when they retire. It would feel weird to pay into a thing that you're guaranteed in retirement, but then you don't get it when you retire.
Sure, it's just a tax, though. At that point, you just got taxed higher.
I guess. I don't know.
ASOS linked a thing and said means testing would only save like 2%.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I feel like I think raising the cap on how much of your income it applies to. I don't even know how many earners actually are over 176K. What is the top 1% income?
Probably not many.
Actually, yeah, that might not even help that much. Top 1% income US.
Oh.
Is 730 to 800K. I wonder what for top 5%.
What's top 10%? Top 10% is 210K.
Jesus, you motherfuckers are making way too much money.
Okay, wait, hold on.
We need to go back to poverty time.
Any gifters?
What the fuck?
Wait,
you guys are spoiled.
Top 20% is 130K to 150.
Yeah, I'm seeing top quintile, which is 20, is, yeah, I see 117 in 2022. Okay, maybe that would raise.
I mean, that seems like it'd raise a good amount of money.
An okay chunk of change.
Where's Doge? They could have done this, right?
Yeah, the other thing that people really don't like to hear, but raising the retirement age is another thing you could do.
No, I don't think they're going to do that. What is it right now, 62?
I thought it was 65. Age for full Social Security benefits.
What do you want to raise it to? 67?
Good one. Oh, it is 67.
Oh!
But this is like, yeah, political suicide.
I mean, that's pretty high. No? Already?
Yeah, people don't like that. Well, but we also live longer now, too.
We are.
Motherfuckers, need to work more. What are you retiring at 67 for?
The average person live? The average person lives to 72?
Wait, in the U.S.?
In the USA. I didn't type
it. Yeah, it's got to be like 78 or something, no?
78.4.
Okay.
So they get some, what, 11 years?
Get him out of here. Get him out of here.
Raise it to 70, fuck it.
Hell yeah. Make it race bait. Just kidding.
True. How hard is it to prompt?
Prompt what?
Well, if we raise the age, they're just going to need to prompt harder for more years.
True. In a sudden turn of events, U.S. 12-month inflation expectations have surged to 5.2%, the highest level since March 2023.
Problem?
Oh, shit. I understand all of it now. Trump is just trying to get those rate cuts.
Inflation go up means rate cuts don't happen, right? Or is it the other way around?
Rate cuts do happen. If you borrow money easier, you spend money more, usually pushes prices up. Wait, when inflation goes up, you usually want rates to go up because you want to slow down the velocity of money through the economy. I don't remember what you initially asked me, but if the inflation is getting higher, usually the Fed wants to increase the interest rate. If the inflation rate is lower,
so then Trump is going to be pissed off then because the interest rate might get increased and he wants it to go down.
Yeah, correct. So never mind that. What he referred around that didn't make sense. I don't know. He's just fucked. I'm trying to find something for him, okay?
It's all right, man. You try your best.
The Federal Reserve has two mandates, though. It's for unemployment and it's for inflation. And if you have inflation going, so generally, if inflation is getting higher, you want to increase rates to slow down the money through the economy. If inflation is getting lower, then you can loosen up on rates so that more money can flow through the economy. And as unemployment goes up, you want rates to go down. As unemployment goes down, you want rates to go up. Yes. So you have to balance these things together.
Yeah.
Hopefully, these things are moving opposite one another when employment, because what you don't want to happen ever, there's a thing called, this concept is like stagflation or whatever. If you have it so that your inflation is increasing, but your unemployment is increasing as well, you're in a rough spot for your economy because the Federal Reserve looks at the increase in inflation, things are getting more expensive, which makes them want to increase interest rates. But if unemployment is going up and more people are losing their jobs, if you increase your interest rates, it tends to slow down money in the economy, which would hurt people who are unemployed by making even more people unemployed. So when those things start moving in tandem with each other, you're in a very scary spot.
Isn't this precisely what's happening in the U.S. right now then?
Kind of, sort of, yeah. But
they released job growth numbers and they were fucked.
Yeah. The unemployment, though, I think natural rate of unemployment you usually shoot for in an economy is about 5%, and it's been low for quite a while. So it can, like, there's a bit of wiggle room on that. I don't know where we're at right now, though.
U.S. unemployment.
I think it's still below
4.4%.
Right? Yeah. So technically, we still have wiggle room there.
But if it keeps getting worse and worse, then the U.S. is in, like, a real fuck spot.
If both of those, if they move in tandem, yeah, that would be bad.
What's up, Metaline?
Yo.
Howdy. Give me the well, actually.
So I logged Destiny, then.
The situation in America is kind of fucked with Trump's deportations because he kind of makes it very hard for the Fed to do their dual mandate because they even talk about this, but I mean, everyone knows it. Is that, like, if you're exploiting loads of people and you've got, like, a zero kind of default, like, job growth number, so it's, like, zero, literally, that's the equilibrium, then they if they hike because of inflation is going up, which is going to happen because of this stuff, they're also risking unemployment. They don't know how strong the economy is because, like, having zero equilibrium makes it incredibly hard to deal with. So, like, yeah, I wouldn't say we're in stagflation yet. I mean, some people think we've already been in stagflation the last, like, 4 or 5 years since COVID, because we've had, like, higher than average inflation than we want. And also, you know, we've had growth, but like inflation's been going up and employment's been going up as well, or up and down. But it's never usually like one direction.
Sure. When you say we haven't, there's no equilibrium, do you mean because we're like doing so many different things at once that it's hard to know where anything's going to
settle? Oh, when I said the equilibrium, I mean specifically just for job growth.
Gotcha. Wait, was it true that Jay Powell said that there have been essentially no new jobs created in the past 6 months? Is that?
I think I was probably referring to revisions, but those, it's really, I would never really look at that sort of stuff. One, like revisions can, lots of people saw it, but it's one of those things where it's like, it doesn't really matter because it's like, it has no bearing on like the Fed's policy. For example, and it like they say that they're backward related, but they're not gonna, like, if it's really obvious like that there is some level of employment in the, like, because you'll see it in demand, right? Like you'll see it in like personal expansion, consumer expenditure and stuff like that. So it's, even though the revisions can come and there can be like a really bad report like last time we've talked about, it's not worth it. Like the employment, the labor industry can be really weird, like short term, like 6 months.
Okay, any final thoughts for my last minute here?
No.